COVAX's only confirmed legally binding agreement is for up to 200 million doses of vaccine, though that includes an option to order several times that number of additional doses. It has agreements for another 500 million vaccines, but those are not legally binding. The 200 million doses will come from the Serum Institute of India, the company that will likely make a large proportion of the coronavirus shots destined for the developing world. The chief executive officer of Serum Institute of India, Adar Punawala, says it has a confirmed order for 100 million doses of the vaccine, each for a vaccine developed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca, and one from Novavax. He told the Associated Press, "We don't have anything beyond that in writing," adding, "If they want more, they'll have to place more orders." He said the lack of commitment from COVAX will mean a much longer wait for people in developing countries. Adar Punawala also noted that his company's first priority would be making shots for India, which has suggested it wants at least 300 million vaccines. Punawala said it's likely India would not be able to take all of those at once, but a big order could delay the distribution of vaccines for other parts of the developing world. Potentially further slowing down the process is that neither the AstraZeneca vaccine nor the Novavax vaccine has been licensed by any regulatory agency yet, and any injection distributed by COVAX will likely need World Health Organization approval. COVAX does not have any supplies of the two vaccines that claim to be most effective so far, the Pfizer-BioNTech shot and the Moderna one. The United Kingdom has already begun giving the Pfizer vaccine, and the United States and Canada are rolling it out recently. Still, Gavi claimed they aim to start rolling out safe and effective vaccines to COVAX member countries at scale within the first and second quarters of the new year. Dr. Gagandeep Kang, an infectious diseases expert at the Christian Medical College at Vellore in southern India, noted even with vaccines in hand, the rollouts will take many months, even in rich countries, and many developing ones are facing serious logistical challenges that will add to delays. Even senior officials at the World Health Organization have acknowledged privately that attempts to fairly allocate vaccine through the initiative are flawed, despite publicly lauding its success. Dr. Catherine O'Brien, World Health Organization's vaccine chief, during a recent internal discussion, a recording of which was obtained by the Associated Press, said, "The whole call for global solidarity has mostly been lost." Asked to clarify her remarks, Catherine O'Brien said in an email that every country should have access to COVID-19 vaccines as early as feasible. Adding to COVAX's difficulties, Catherine O'Brien noted at a news conference recently that it was still $5 billion short to buy the doses of vaccine it's planning to obtain next year. According to a report Gavi issued ahead of a meeting in coming days, the alliance itself concluded that the risk COVAX will fail is very high, saying it was established in record time and has to navigate uncharted territory. But John Nkengasong, director of the Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention, criticized Western countries for buying up the global vaccine supply in excess of their needs, while we here in Africa are still struggling with a COVAX effort. With no certainty about which shots would work, governments scrambled in recent months to sign multiple deals to ensure their citizens would have at least some COVID-19 vaccine injections. For example, Canada bought nearly 200 million vaccines, enough to cover its population of 38 million, about five times over. John Nkengasong called the idea that people in rich countries would get immunized while Africans go without a vaccine a moral issue. Beyond the ethics, experts note that failing to protect people in the developing world will leave a reservoir of coronavirus that could spark new outbreaks at any time. Amid fears COVAX can't deliver, some developing countries are pulling out entirely or seeking their own private deals. Earlier this month, the tiny Pacific island nation of Palau announced it was abandoning the initiative and claimed it would get donated vaccines from the United States instead. Other low- and middle-income countries, including Malaysia, Peru, and Bangladesh, have stayed in the initiative, but also recently inked their own deals with drug makers as a Plan B. Anban Pillay of the South African Ministry of Health said that joining COVAX was just a stopgap measure before signing bilateral deals with pharmaceutical companies. Kate Elder, Vaccines Policy Advisor at Doctors Without Borders, said, "It's increasingly looking like the ship has sailed on equitable vaccine distribution. And Gavi, World Health Organization and others need to discuss how to increase vaccine manufacturing." To that end, South Africa and India have asked the World Trade Organization WTO to waive some provisions regulating intellectual property rights to make it easier for manufacturers in poor countries to make COVID-19 drugs and vaccines. But many rich countries are reluctant to do that. Anna Marriott, health policy manager at Oxfam, said as more countries in the West authorize the vaccine, the difference between people in rich countries getting vaccinated and the lack of any vaccines for the developing world will become quite stark. She added, and it will only prolong the pandemic.
Iran Today.
This is a poem sung to the river Araz or Aras, which ran through the north of Iran about a couple of hundred years ago. Today, it is the waterline dividing Iran and what used to be its ultra-north provinces. And that is how a poem struck discord. It's a reminder of exactly that separation, and it was recited by Turkish President Erdogan at a Baku parade, a victory parade celebrating a ceasefire agreement between Armenia and the Republic of Azerbaijan, an agreement that allowed Azerbaijan to reclaim control over broad swathes of Nagorno-Karabakh and surrounding lands. Now, how did it get there, and why did Erdogan recite that particular poem in celebration? For answers, stay with me, Leyla Faromarzi, on Iran Today. Today's map portrays an Iran bordering all three, Turkey, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. So when decades-long fighting reignited in September between Armenia and Azerbaijan, the war spilled into Iran by proximity alone. On top of it all, Azerbaijan gained the upper hand, partly because with Turkey, it stationed at Iran's borders both its archenemy Israel and Takfiri Syrian terrorists. So the way Turkey helped was no favor to Iran, and why it was so eager to help Azerbaijan was questionable. Mr. Parkayin was ambassador to the Republic of Azerbaijan. He shared his thoughts with us at his souvenir-packed house.
This poem directly provokes ethnic sentiments and questions the territorial integrity of the Islamic Republic of Iran. while promoting a kind of pan-Azerism and, in Mr. Erdogan's own words, pan-Turkism. After Mr. Erdogan recited the poem, sensitivities arose in Iran.
Azerbaijan is an Azeri Turkish-speaking republic ripped away from Azeri mainland, which is Iran's northwesternmost province today. So when Turkey's first man sang a song of separation between the two Azerbaijans, it sounded like he was calling for Iran's Azerbaijan to pull away to join its long-lost sister, the Republic of Azerbaijan, and then Big Brother Turkey, forming a pan-Turkic alliance. Iran wouldn't claim being Big Brother to its long-lost former provinces and Khanates. So why would Turkey do so, or did it? Turkey explained Mr. Erdogan's mistake, as in he must have misunderstood the poem. I asked Mr. Parkayin what he thought the Turkish president meant.
What do you think of Erdogan's recitation of that specific poem?
One of the reasons for this discussion is Erdogan's expansionist and ambitious view of reviving the Ottoman Empire. Of course, he targets what he calls Turkish-speaking countries and tries to unite those nations under the leadership of Turkey. Well, this idea, formed in 1991 after the collapse of the Soviet Union, gradually went out of the picture and was not welcomed by Turkish-speaking countries, because these countries believed that now that they had abandoned their big brother, the Soviets, they were not interested in submitting to Turkey as another big brother.
Folks were shocked at the poem recited at the parade. Question is, what was Turkey's first man doing at the Baku Victory Parade to begin with? Mr. Kakai is an IRIB analyst with the capability of splitting hairs, which is typical. He came to Press TV studios to share his thoughts.
Azerbaijan organized the parade exactly a month after the Russian brokered peace agreement was reached with Armenia. Holding this parade means a celebration of victory, a propaganda technique that is used for both domestic and regional use. This was a change that came about after 30 years.
What the poem actually says, what it is actually doing, is that it weeps for both sides, both for Iran losing a part of itself and also for that child that was taken from its motherland. In other words, if anything, it is wishing the lost parts of Azerbaijan back to Iran, to its motherland, and not the other way round. But the pan-Turkic movement misconstrues the meaning, redirecting it to drive dissent in Iran and create a new country. As if there aren't already far too many borders created less than a century ago in this part of the world. Look at Israel and newborn states south of the Persian Gulf. As for how Iran's north, that's areas north of the Aras River, was ripped away from this country, it followed the Russo-Persian War. In concluding that war, the Qajar dynasty of Iran felt its hand forced to sign the Turkmenchai Treaty in 1828. That followed the also notorious Golestan Treaty of 1813. Turkmenchai saw Persia or Iran cede control of several areas south of the Caucasus to Russia, those areas being the Iravan and Nakhchivan Khanates and what remained of the Talish Khanate. With the Treaty of Turkmenchai, the boundary between Russia and Persia, or Iran, was set at the Aras River. With the dissolution of the Soviet Union, those states were cut loose, and Iran recognized their sovereignty. Never mind Eastern Caspian states lost to Iran thanks to Russia and its development into the Soviet Union. However, Iran has a very 21st century outlook to the issue, unlike Turkey, it would seem. We had to make a bit of a trip to meet Mr. Rezvanpur. It was worth it, as you will see by his comments.
It was the ineffectiveness of ruling of Qajar dynasty to protect Iranian territories in the face of Russian invasion in northern Iran. You see, in Fateh Ali Shah area, we saw that by signing two treaties, Golestan and Turkmenchai, we lost more than 200,000 miles of our territories to the Russian Empire. So we just lost our territory to Russia, and after that we just, you know, witnessed different kinds of consequences by losing these territories.
Iran summoned Turkey's ambassador to Tehran Friday. That's the day after the Turkish president's remarks, which Iran said support a secession of Azeri parts of Iran. Not just that. Earlier in the day, Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif had tweeted, President Erdogan was not informed that what he ill-recited in Baku refers to the forcible separation of areas north of Aras from Iranian motherland. Didn't he realize that he was undermining the sovereignty of the Republic of Azerbaijan? No one can talk about our beloved Azerbaijan. Turco-Iranian ties are solidly unbreachable. But can't Turkish foreign policy damage Iran's ties with other regional states? Here's the answer.
It does not seem to be the case, meaning that Turkey does not have this power. It considers its own influence so it can strengthen its position in the region. But Iran's relationship with Azerbaijan is a distinct one that is based on other considerations, interests, and commonalities. This can't be ignored. Therefore, Turkey is unlikely to be capable of disrupting these relations. During the Karabakh War, there were many talks of Takfiri groups being deployed to the region. But this is one side of the issue. Another aspect is Iran's view on this matter. Iran cannot accept a change in the geopolitics of the region or its ethnic situation. For example, changes to the borders or conditions that would threaten Iran's national security will be unacceptable for Tehran. Iran won't tolerate it.
But the Turks appeared as offended as Iranians, given Iran and Turkey have embassies in one another's territories and could have used them as a means of communication, rather than tweets and media accounts. Both countries did eventually summon the ambassadors.
There's more to be said on Iran's regional policy centering on the Aras and Caspian region. Also on how Iran and Turkey handle the case of the explosive poem. But first, a quick media review with Shahzad.
Hi, my name is Shahzad Manateri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on the Iran-Turkey dispute, Iran's unwavering protection of sovereignty. The Daily Sabah reports, Erdogan says, Turkey-Azerbaijan alliance to continue to overcome challenges. As long as Turkey and Azerbaijan have each other's backs, the countries will continue to successfully overcome challenges, President Erdogan said during a victory parade in Baku celebrating the recent liberation of Nagorno-Karabakh over three decades of Armenian occupation. I believe Azerbaijan will continue to make history under the presidency of Ilham Aliyev, Erdogan said, congratulating his Azerbaijani counterpart on the victory. He called on Azerbaijan and Armenia to rethink relations, as nothing can be gained under the Western imperialist goading. IFP News claims Iran ready to keep Karabakh peace, reconstruct Azeri region, says President. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has expressed the country's readiness to play a role in maintaining a ceasefire between the Republic of Azerbaijan and Armenia, and to take part in the process of reconstruction in the recently liberated Azeri lands. The president also expressed satisfaction with the cessation of a recent war between Baku and Yerevan, the liberation of occupied Azeri territories, and the establishment of a ceasefire. Pointing to Iran's proposed plan for the settlement of the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict and deployment of special envoys to Russia, the Republic of Azerbaijan and Armenia, President Rouhani voiced the Islamic Republic's readiness to play a constructive role in maintaining the truce between Baku and Yerevan and ensuring stability in the region. Xinhua Net states Iran's foreign minister urges regional dialogue to settle issues. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif called for a regional dialogue to settle regional issues. In a Twitter message originally in Arabic language, Zarif said, "It seems that some neighbors are asking the West to be part of the negotiation process with Iran. However, Iran will not negotiate with the West over the regional issues," he said, adding that Western interventions have been a cause of problems for the region. Iran is always ready for dialogue with its neighbors, and it has already proposed mechanisms for regional security and peace through regional talks, he said. That's all for this segment.
Turkish Foreign Minister Çavuşoğlu called his Iranian counterpart a couple of days after the incident. That would be December the 12th, when he assured Zarif his country respects Iran's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Both countries expressed their resolve to effectively implement their bilateral decisions on the basis of mutual interests.
I believe that when we discuss Iran-Turkey relations, there is a solid background and a stable relationship between the two sides that is strong and ever-growing. We must avoid explaining the bilateral relationships by focusing on the roles the two sides are playing in the region, as they are both partners and rivals. Both have their interests and considerations in the region. It's only natural that every country makes decisions with regard to its own interests and national security. But Turkey and Iran are two important countries and players in the region and have good relations with each other, and that's unlikely to change in the future.
Another motive for Turkey's regional policy and alliances is its growing isolation and a combination of broader geopolitical factors. Factors such as Iran and the Caucasus, which are making for a fresh bid to normalize Turkish-Israeli ties. We have some top-notch experts on tonight. Mr. Khashe joined us in the studio. Wish you could ask him anything directly on the Caucasus and Iranian relations.
There are long-term strategic relations as well as loyalty between Iran, Turkey, and also Azerbaijan. Why has Turkey brought Israel into the equation?
Turkey's relationship with the Zionist regime can be analyzed from several aspects. From a regional point of view, they have some kind of common goals and interests and are not in conflict with each other. The link between all this is at the regional level, and that is the Islamic Republic of Iran. They look at Iran as a regional competitor. They also have identified their interests and areas of activity in the region, especially in the Caucasus. For example, the Zionist regime imports energy resources from the Republic of Azerbaijan. These resources pass through the Turkish territory, for which Ankara charges a fee. Turkey also controls the pipelines. The two sides cooperate in other areas as well. There isn't a single issue over which the interests of the two would conflict, nor is there anything that would put them in front of each other.
Iran, apparently unlike Turkey, believes that regional development requires security and stability in the region. Stability is paramount to preventing the entry of trans-regional forces such as Israel and the United States into the region. Israel has established itself in West Asia, but even Muslim Asian parts surrounding the Caucasus are a far cry for it. However, they border on Iran and Russia, those states, and that is strategic for Israel militarily as well as economically. Do notice, by the way, the support Azerbaijan received from Israel and Turkey in contrast to Armenia. Azerbaijan has a wealth of oil, Caspian oil, which Armenia does not.
What exactly is Israel after in the Caucasus, getting involved in the Armenia-Azerbaijan conflict, etc., etc.?
The Zionist regime has various goals in its presence in the Caucasus and the Republic of Azerbaijan. The main priority is the shared border between the Republic of Azerbaijan and Iran. It's important for Israel, as Iran's number one enemy, to have a base near the Islamic Republic of Iran. Israel's other goals in the region involve oil resources. As you know, 40% of the Zionist regime's energy sources are provided by the Republic of Azerbaijan. The third point is that the Zionist regime views the Republic of Azerbaijan as an arms market, and major contracts have been concluded between the two sides.
To Iran, foreign meddling in its affairs is nothing new, albeit it has to remain constantly alert. The unity of different Iranian ethnic groups has always been a target for the country's enemies. For example, the British took measures to create divisions and then separate parts of Iran, such as Herat and later Khuzestan. Mind you, the ethnic minorities I'm out to name are hardly ethnic, but many of their members have been made to think so by those very foreign powers. This would help divide and rule this country, although they haven't gotten beyond descent those powers. And that too, not with whole ethnicities.
Talking of pan-Turkism, how Turkish are the Azeris really, at least the Azeris of Iran till today? How Turkish are they for them to be stirred as Turks?
First of all, talk about their religious background. 95% of Azeri population are Shiites, Shiite Muslims, okay? And most of them are, the followers of 12 Imam in Shiite, Islamic calendar. But regarding the ethnicity, regarding the language, yes, they are certainly talking Azeri, not Turkish, okay? But Azerbaijan is trying to make itself closer to the Turkish, ambition of making one nation, one country with two nations. It was the motto of President Heydar Aliyev.
Turkey tries very hard to represent the peoples of Central Asia and the Caucasus as the same as the Anatolian Turks and the Ottoman Turks. But these countries do not accept it. In the Republic of Azerbaijan, for example, people are more attached to Iranian Azeris than to the Turkish-speaking people in Turkey. We do not even see this as a threat. We regard the presence of Azeris in the Republic of Azerbaijan, along with Iranian Azeris, as an opportunity for cooperation and development of bilateral relations. That is why we have abolished visas, allowing Azerbaijani citizens to easily travel to Iran and visit Azeri-speaking areas. Some of them have families in Iran. And on the contrary, some Azeris have acquaintances on the other side of Aras River.
Azerbaijanis or Azeris have of late been introduced as the second most numerous ethnic group among the Turkic peoples after Turkish people. And the world's largest number of Azeris live in Iran, followed by the Republic of Azerbaijan. So you can see how the ground is fertile for dissent.
In fact, the Azeris in this country are well aware of their deeper roots, and they have fought hard and fast for Iran against the Ottoman Empire in the 16th century. Going way back in time, Azerbaijan is an Iranian, not Turkish or Uyghur stronghold. In fact, the Median prophet Zoroaster is said to be of that region. Zoroaster, the monotheist prophet who upheld fire as a symbol of wisdom and purity. In fact, Azerbaijan or Azerbaijan means protect or protector of fire. Azer means fire in Persian. Even if Erdogan had the best of intentions by choosing the Aras poem, how dangerous can it be? What would be the implications in this region?
By pursuing nationalistic ideals, they are trying to just make a division. You see, President Erdogan made this statement in order to shore up the support of Iran Azeris, but he didn't get any, result, because he made a mistake. And after that, it showed Iranian officials a strong disapproval of President Erdogan's statements. But I think that, there is a hand of foreigners which are trying to interfere between the Iranian and Azeri and Turkish relationships in order to just make a discord.
Iran has both maintained its own post-World War unity and has made great efforts for the security of the Caucasus by unity and neighborly behavior. In fact, in the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, it tried to take a position for fewer people to be killed and for peace to return to the region faster. Iran both exports gas to Turkey and has large imports coming in from Turkey. And the two states have a security cooperation going to counter terrorists present in the region, such as PKK and Pejak. And this doesn't read with Turkey now facilitating ISIS or Daesh dispatches to Iran's nearabouts. One could say Iran's strong reaction to the Turkish president is to protect the Irano-Turkish Brotherhood, because to Iran, territorial integrity is its birthright. It is so ancient that its beginnings have blurred, and territorial integrity is again maintained by stability and national unity. But then, perhaps at worst, Mr. Erdogan just sought to undermine Tehran-Baku relations by addressing sensitive issues such as the bonds between the two sides of the Aras River. That would not make it any less unfair or disloyal. Turkey would do well to remember Iran's position during the coup era, as Azerbaijan should remember how Iran stressed its territorial claim to the Nagorno-Karabakh district in its war with Armenia.
There was a time when even Erdogan's original allies were against him, and almost everyone had come to the conclusion that he was leaving. Nevertheless, the Islamic Republic of Iran stood by Erdogan. This was because of Iran's principled doctrines. Iran always supports the territorial integrity of countries. It supports governments that are legally recognized. This is not a tendentious position, but one based on the principles and norms of international law. Accordingly, the Islamic Republic of Iran upheld these principles and supported Erdogan as the legitimate president of Turkey.
Iran's position towards Turkey has been favorable all along, as with the latest coup. Turkey doesn't seem to be returning the favor. However, it is questionable whether Turkey actually needed help in reeling in a coup.
Turkey's approach towards its domestic and foreign policy underwent a dramatic change following the failed coup nearly 4 years ago. Inside the country, many journalists, political, civil and social activists were arrested. Even the European Union heavily criticized Turkey. This way, Turkey used heightened security measures from within the country, which meant more restrictions for the Kurds and different dissident sectors, groups and parties. In the field of foreign policy, we have witnessed an increasing tendency towards militarization on the part of Turkey over the past 4 years.
That's it for today. Thanks for joining us in our story of the Aras and its pure pastel green waters and the lands surrounding it, Armenia and Azerbaijan, the Republic of Azerbaijan to the north and Iran to the south. Not to forget Turkey, Iran's northwestern neighbor. Bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Before Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine was proved highly successful in clinical trials last month, the company offered the Trump administration the chance to lock in supplies beyond the 100 million doses. The pharmaceutical maker agreed to sell the government as part of a $1.95 billion deal months ago. But the Trump administration, according to people familiar with the talks, never made the deal, a choice that now raises questions about whether the United States allowed other countries to take its place in line. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Sharon Lafreniere, Katie Thomas, and Noah Weiland. The piece is titled, Trump Administration Officials Passed When Pfizer Offered Months Ago to Sell the U.S. More Vaccine Doses. Stay with us for more of Sharon Lafreniere, Katie Thomas, and Noah Weiland's article. Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine was proved highly successful in clinical trials last month. The company offered the Trump administration the chance to lock in supplies beyond the 100 million doses. The pharmaceutical maker agreed to sell the government as part of a $1.95 billion deal months ago. But the Trump administration, according to people familiar with the talks, never made the deal, a choice that now raises questions about whether the United States allowed other countries to take its place in line. As the administration scrambles to try to purchase more doses of the vaccine, President Trump on Tuesday issued an executive order that proclaimed that other nations will not get the U.S. supplies of its vaccine until Americans have been inoculated. But the order appears to have no real teeth and does not expand the U.S. supply of vaccine doses, according to a description of the order on Monday by senior administration officials. The vaccine, being produced by Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech, is a two-dose treatment, meaning that 100 million doses of the vaccine is enough to vaccinate only 50 million Americans. The vaccine is expected to receive authorization for emergency use in the United States as soon as this weekend, with another vaccine developed by Moderna also likely to be approved for emergency use soon. Britain, meanwhile, began its vaccination drive on Tuesday, 8th of December, using the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, making it the first Western nation to start mass vaccinations. On 11th of November, 2 days after Pfizer first announced early results indicating that its vaccine was more than 90% effective, the European Union announced that it had finalized a supply deal with Pfizer and BioNTech for 200 million doses of the vaccine, a deal they began negotiating in months earlier. Shipments could begin by the end of the year, and the contract includes an option for 100 million more doses of the vaccine. Asked if the Trump administration had missed a crucial chance to snap up more doses for Americans, a spokeswoman for the Department of Health and Human Services said, "We are confident that we will have 100 million doses of Pfizer's vaccine as agreed to in our contract, and beyond that, we have five other vaccine candidates." The U.S. government was in July given the option to request 100 million to 500 million additional doses of the vaccine. But despite repeated warnings by Pfizer officials that demand could vastly outstrip supply, and amid urges to pre-order more doses of the vaccine, the Trump administration turned down the offer, according to several people familiar with the discussions. In a statement, Pfizer said that any additional doses beyond the 100 million doses of vaccine are subject to a separate and mutually acceptable agreement, and that the company is not able to comment on any confidential discussions that may be taking place with the U.S. government. The bulk of the global supply of vaccines has already been claimed by industrialized countries like the United States, Canada, Britain, and various countries in Europe, leading to criticism that people in low- and middle-income countries will be left behind. The United States has declined to participate in a global initiative called COVAX that is meant to make a vaccine available globally to all populations. The decision to issue the executive order by Donald Trump was reported earlier by Fox News.
Internet Trolls. The Internet. What began as an exclusive tool to connect militaries, governments, and then universities has now, more than 60 years later, transformed everything about how modern societies operate and communicate. Today, no one can escape the grasp of social media or evade the mind-boggling connectivity that nearly all humans worldwide now have access to. But few have been prepared for what has also emerged with all this human connectedness. A new and ominous strain of human behavior has been unleashed. Increasingly, people are hiding behind a cloak of anonymity, waiting to provoke, harass, and even threaten anyone they choose. They are called internet trolls.
A troll is someone devoting large parts of their life to attacking other people on the internet, basically trying to make that other person's life miserable in some way.
They send things to my home. It terrifies me to think what they could do if they wanted to, knowing exactly where I live, knowing where my children go to school.
Trolls can be a minor annoyance or a life-crippling terror. But what happens if society tries to silence them? Who loses then?
Trolling is a free speech issue. And if you aren't free to hate someone, then you're not free.
I've been associated with all kinds of organized trolling groups. We're stretching the bounds of free speech. You either use it or you lose it. Feelings will be hurt.
Politicians and the courts are now grappling with who really is a dangerous troll.
I've been called troll by very powerful people that should know better. Homophobe, misogynist, racist, all this stuff is just lazy people not wanting to interact.
Artist Gregory Allen Elliott is at the center of a landmark trolling case that might land him behind bars and forever change what any of us anywhere can or cannot say online.
If Mr. Elliott is convicted of a criminal offense, watch out. Nobody will be safe. You better shut up, because if you don't, you could be going to jail.
My name is Gina Crosley Corcoran. I write a blog called The Feminist Breeder, and I deal with a really steady onslaught of very vicious and dedicated trolls. Trolls can be really, really sneaky. When you think about patterns of stalking, stalkers don't just do it really quietly. They leave their victim clues that they're being stalked in order to scare them. So today I got a Working Person's Store magazine addressed to the Feminist Breeder with my home address. My trolls sent me this, probably to imply that I'm too lazy to find a real job besides blogging. So, guys, hey! Come here, pumpkin pie.
Gina's blog earns her family a decent income. She writes about being a stay-at-home mom, but from a pro-choice, modern feminist perspective. And a large, active community of like-minded women has grown around her blog.
I like to see that recognition response when someone else goes, oh, me too. And that's so validating. That's why I do it.
Feminists are frequently targeted by trolls. Gina knew to expect attacks, but she's been overwhelmed by the volume of abuse and stunned to discover who her trolls are.
The trolls and the really dangerous people that I attract are themselves mothers and have small children at home. They get something out of taking out their frustrations on someone like me. They see me as a figurehead, and they're really angry about the attention I'm getting from people, and they want to discredit me in any way they possibly can. These people spend all day taking screenshots of every word I type on the internet. They all pick it apart. They talk about my children. They talk about my clothes. They spend an incredible amount of energy focusing exclusively on something that they claim to completely hate. And to me, that's the difference between someone who just disagrees with you or someone who's really stalking every move you make. And those are the trolls.
Gina sees little difference between her trolls and a stalker. They want to see her react, and they know how to push her buttons.
A stalker wants to upset that person. They want to make them afraid. And that's what these trolls do. They leave comments in such a way that makes you feel afraid of what they're going to do and say. They'll leave comments about my address or my kids, and they do it because they want to get a reaction out of me. They want to see me lash out, and it all feeds into this sick and twisted entertainment value to them.
So what is it that motivates trolls? In London, England, psychologist Raj Persaud believes the internet has spawned an entirely new, yet unexplored, set of human behaviors.
Psychologists and psychiatrists have been somewhat taken back by the huge amount of negativity there appears to be on the internet. And it may be that the internet has unleashed a kind of dark demon within millions of people out there in the general public. We think that one of the things that's problematic about the internet is it normalizes extreme behavior. So because you see a lot of people on the internet behaving in an extreme fashion, you think it's more normal than it might actually be. And the other thing is it seems to encourage a herd-like piece of behavior. If one person starts being negative and a group of people pile in behind them, there's a kind of cascade effect, which you don't see in ordinary life outside of the internet.
Psychologists further believe that one thing has compounded the effects and numbers of trolls.
Anonymity seems to be a very important factor on the internet in that it seems to make people less inhibited about doing nasty things. It means that people feel free to get away with bad behavior because they think they're not going to get called to account. No one's going to point the finger at them. So the anonymity effect seems very important and may explain why so much dark and negative and extreme behavior occurs on the internet but doesn't seem to occur in real life, in face-to-face interaction.
But what inspires a troll? What do they get out of it? Operating out of an undisclosed location in North America, one hardcore and self-professed troll agreed to tell us, provided we maintained his anonymity.
I'm Wild Goose, and I'm a member of the Bill Wagoner crew. And I've done a podcast for the past several years documenting internet troll activity, hacker activity, Gamergate, Anonymous, Occupy, you name it. I've been a part of it. There's a serious darkness in not only us, but I think in everybody online. I think a lot of people just don't tap into the power of anonymity and what it can do for them. When you're anonymous, you're free to do and say a lot of things that you otherwise wouldn't do in real life. You would be powerless to do in real life.
Goose joined forces with like-minded trolls he met online, and they work as a team to offend and infuriate as many people as they can.
If you were to Google Bill Wagoner crew, chances are you'd come across a term called rip trolling. When somebody dies and their family puts up a memorial up in their honor, we might set up a separate page, or we might just go on that page and create a ruckus. But the idea is to get as many followers as possible on that page and make it seem as legit as possible so that we can offend as many people as possible when we start posting gore and other kinds of shocking material.
Hounding people when they are most vulnerable, like at the time of a loved one's funeral, is a surefire hit for the troll.
That's the easiest way for us to create a mass effect. It's really effective when you have all these people who are already emotional. Drop this bomb on them, you know, with the gore photos, maybe some kind of sexually explicit photos. It sends their emotions into overdrive.
But what do the trolls get out of seeing these distraught reactions? Lulz. L-U-L-Z. That's the currency of the troll, and it's what they're after. Lulls are laughs, fun and amusement at the expense of others. The Wagoner crew will prod people online for reactions. The bigger their response, the more popular the target becomes.
Someone who gets really animated and waves their arms around on camera, preferably, or they'll scream into a microphone on a podcast, they might start crying, they become a lulz cow. They're like an ongoing target. We love that kind of reaction. We want to make them cry. We love to make them cry.
The open internet is a playground for goose and trolls like him. And the stark contrast to what they can get away with in normal society is not lost on them.
I really can't. I mean, the real world's so boring and it's lacking in lulls. It really is. I don't think we'd be able to find this in real life. The internet presented something that was never available to us before.
Today, if you go on the internet, you're entering the domain of the troll. But where did internet trolling all start? This unassuming computer science professor may hold the answer and may himself be one of the very first trolls on the internet.
I'm Dr. Adam Steele. I am an associate professor of computer science at DePaul University in Chicago. I think I'm the first recorded troll on the internet. Certainly not the first troll, but the first one that was actually written up. This is a piece that is here because my wife hates it, called The Alchemist. I didn't really notice, but it sure does look like a troll, and I guess he's stirring the pot.
Adam would first access the internet while attending university in the province of Quebec, Canada. And it wouldn't be long until he was stirring the pot with his wry sense of humor.
I was a grad student in 1993 at Concordia University in Montreal. Essentially, at that time, the internet was still very nascent, and at that point was just a relatively small number of universities that were connected together. And there was this kind of quasi-bulletin board system called the News Network. You had, for example, a group like Rec.Humor, and people would trade jokes, and I guess what happened at some point was that there were people on Rec.Humor who had a certain penchant for tasteless jokes that was not appreciated by the rest of the community. And so the tasteless denizens were kind of hived off and started their own group, and Alt.Tasteless was born.
As the chat group Alt.Tasteless got going, the jokes started to get more and more extreme. But soon, the jokes just couldn't get the rise they wanted.
I think it was a long, hot summer, and everybody was kind of getting a little bored. And there was this idea that the people of Alt.Tasteless should invade a news group, and somebody suggested Rec.Pets.Cats.
Yes, cat lovers would be the next target, and Adam would be the lead.
Like any community, they wanted to discuss problems that their cats had. So I guess my contribution was that we should actually engage them by writing a story that would appear to be from somebody who was genuinely concerned, get them to respond, a stealth attack. So I created a fictitious identity, and it was posted anonymously to Rec.Pets.Cats.
And what happened next would be recognized by Wired magazine as something that had never happened on the internet before.
I have two cats. Sootykin, 2-year-old female, and Chode. Chode's problem is that he has really stinky shits, paint peelers.
Adam's post was vulgar and over the top, but he took care to keep it believable.
Sooty goes into heat something fierce, yowling and presenting all the time. While dinner was cooking, I tried to stimulate her with a Q-tip because I had heard that one can induce ovulation that way. My date came into the bathroom while I was doing this, and needless to say, I don't think she bought my explanation.
The cat lovers, however, bought Adam's story, hook, line, and sinker.
The initial responses to the post were very helpful and essentially suggested that Sooty should get spayed. Then slowly, other suggestions started popping up.
As the off-color suggestions became grosser and more extreme, the cat lovers were outraged, and the Alt.Tasteless gang had a blast.
So what we did was we essentially trolled, you know, where you throw a lure out behind a boat and motor slowly over the fish until somebody bites.
Adam and the Alt.Tasteless crew had become the internet's first gang of trolls. Back then, Adam was one of about 14 million internet users worldwide. 25 years later, there are 3 billion people online, and the nature of trolling has evolved.
What's happened now is that trolling has taken on a meaning different from the sort of fishing metaphor and more towards that of the troll under the bridge, where someone will post something and the responses will be very destructive, basically laying waste to whatever's been said.
In the early 1990s, Adam and his friends were trolling for fun. But now, negativity is everywhere on the internet. Back in London, Dr. Raj Persaud suspects that we all have a potential troll lurking in our psyches.
The answer to the question of whether we're all potential trolls is delivered by a simple question. Have you ever gossiped negatively about someone else? Because if you have, there's a sense in which you're doing a kind of micro-trolling behavior.
It's not pretty, but science has now proven that putting someone else down can make us feel better about ourselves. And there's a specific name for the feeling that results.
The psychologists are taking increasing interest in what's called the Schadenfreude effect. And Schadenfreude is a word from German, which is about feeling pleasure at someone else's downfall. There are a lot of people on the planet feeling low self-esteem, feeling beaten up by life. Maybe watching other people do badly, watching other people suffer, seems to correct your low self-esteem.
Deriving pleasure from the pain of others is a characteristic we all seem to have to a degree. But psychologists are now finding that hardcore trolls are likely to express four dark personality traits. In Winnipeg, Canada, a landmark study of internet trolls has now shown that one of those dark traits stands above the rest. Sadism.
Sadists do it because they like it. Some people get their jollies by being rude and obnoxious and causing harm to other people, sometimes serious harm to other people, and it gives them pleasure.
Dr. Paul Trapnell and his colleagues have confirmed that the internet, with millions of potential victims and anonymity to hide behind, is a playground for people with sadistic tendencies.
It's a venue where a person can go on and ruffle somebody's feathers or embarrass or humiliate them or make them feel anguish, and there is no consequence to that, and it's easy to do. So that might attract people that take pleasure in harming people, and that seems to be what we found.
Trapnell and his team began their studies by focusing on people who frequently leave comments on message boards. A significant number of them unabashedly rated trolling as their favorite commenting activity.
Then we asked them to also fill out a number of personality questionnaires, and those questionnaires included some measures of well-known, widely studied forms of nasty tendencies. We found, as expected, that the trollers were higher on all of the malevolent traits. It's not a stretch, but nobody had investigated that with data. And so we did so, and sure enough, that's true. Let me illustrate what I mean by these four dark tendencies that have specially toxic social consequences. Psychopathy, we can be callously indifferent by our reckless pursuit of things that we want. In narcissism, we are callously indifferent to others by our pursuit of grandiosity and wanting to hog the limelight, wanting to think that we are superior to other people. Machiavellianism, the pursuit of strategic harm in order to benefit ourselves. Sadism is a particularly malevolent way that we can do harm to others, and that is by seeking to harm people purposely because it's pleasurable to us. So all of us have the potential to be dark in these four different ways. And indeed, some people combine these tendencies in ways that make them especially dark, malevolent individuals. And that is a very, very malevolent person. This is not somebody that you want to have anything to do with at all. Definitely not.
Nasty individuals have had free rein on the internet, and trolling is on the rise. But more and more people are starting to fight back. This accused troll has been forced off the internet for 3 years by a Toronto court. And today, his artwork has been forced off these cafe walls by angry protests. Gregory Allen Elliott.